Good afternoon. I'd like to call the House Resource Committee to order at 1 p.m. We're in room 124. Today is Friday, March the 18th, 2016. Our members present are Representative Johnson, Representative Josephson, Representative Herron, Representative Tarr, Representative Olson, our Vice Chair, serving as our Vice Chair, Representative Chenault, and our my fellow co-chair, Representative Nagiak. I'm Representative Tallarico. So I'd like to let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. I'd also like to recognize our staff. Our secretary today is Julie Kohler, and our teleconference aide is Matt Smith. Thank you both very much for being here. Committee aide Gary Zepp from Representative Nagiak's office is usually in the room, and I don't see him, but I know he will be here at some point in time. And my committee aide up here is Julie Morris. I'd like to ask everyone to please silence or shut your cell phones off for us, if you would, please. And today our first item that we're going to address is House Bill 216, and then we will move to House Bill 274. We have House Bill 247 on our agenda, but we're not ready to bring that forward today. We won't be discussing that today. We are planning on recessing and bringing that back tomorrow at 1 o'clock so that we can continue on with that particular bill. So I'd like to begin with House Bill 216. We've had public testimony already, but there were some questions from the committee members that I had told them that we would address before moving that bill from committee. And if I could, I'd like to ask my staff member Joshua Banks to come forward. Please identify yourself for the record, and maybe you can go through those responses, if you would, for us, Joshua.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Joshua Banks, staff to Representative Tallarico. And the chair has provided a brief memo detailing a few of the questions that were brought up on Wednesday afternoon. And I'll just briefly summarize the memo. So one of the concerns that was brought up by both Representative Seaton and Herron brought forward the concern that inclusion of certain activities on navigable waters could cause harm to certain areas, certain sensitive areas such as salmon spawning grounds. And so we confirmed with both the Department of Fish and Game and the Department of Natural Resources to see what statutes are currently in the books for that would provide some restrictions on what activities could be conducted in certain areas in or around navigable waters. And the Department of Fish and Game notified us of the AS 1605-871, which is titled Protection of Fish and Game. And this requires a person to obtain a permit to conduct certain activities around anadromous waters to ensure that there's adequate protection of fish and game resources. And also, there's a penalty for doing material damage to salmon spawning grounds or disrupting salmon migration. That is AS 1605-896, which is a misdemeanor offense. There are also a few different statutes that the Department of Natural Resources can use to restrict or manage the use of waters through regulation, such as determining what uses are incompatible within a certain area. And overall, and you can see this in the bill on page 1, AS 3805-128A gives permission to a state agency to obstruct the free passage of navigable waters if it is authorized by law or permit issued by a federal or state agency. So if there is something that would be concerned, an activity that could cause harm to different sensitive areas, then there could be a law that if there's an authorization in law, then a department can stop that activity from being conducted. The second question, Representative Josephson brought up Givens v. Ogden Supreme Court case from 1824, and I remember going through school and learn a little bit about that, and I wanted to get a refresher because it piqued my interest to make sure that this wasn't going to cause any problems. And just looking through the information on that case, it deals primarily with interstate commerce, even though the Supreme Court did discuss navigation on different bodies of water. The courts talked about how navigability of a body of water, it didn't deal with navigability unless it was closely associated with interstate commerce. And the final point that the memo discusses is deleting the language "but not limited to," and this was raised by a number of people that testified on Wednesday. And this, as I briefly mentioned on Wednesday, this is just a legal preference that the Legislative Legal Services has started moving towards. Instead of saying including but not limited to, just using the word including gets the same point across with using less words. And I did confirm with Legislative Legal that this was the reason why they deleted those words in this bill. And that's a summary of the memo, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Joshua. I appreciate that. Any comments from the committee? Questions? Thank you, Joshua. I appreciate that. So is there any further committee discussion? Representative Josephson.
Would the chair entertain an amendment?
A conceptual amendment, Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I had Ledge Legal draft an amendment for page 1, line 8 that would add, along with law or permit, the word regulation. And I have a couple copies of that amendment here.
Prior to that, Representative Josephson, would you move that as amendment number one?
Thank you. Please. I would move this as amendment number one.
Okay, and I'll object for discussion purposes.
All right.
Mr. Chairman, before we start discussing that, I'd like to see a copy of it.
Okay, we will get those distributed. We'll take a brief at ease. Call the meeting back to order. And Representative Josephson, you had moved conceptual amendment number one, and I had objected to it. So if you'd like to speak to that.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And I just want to remind the committee that, just as like a housekeeping thing, our normal procedure is we normally request these 24 hours in advance. So just as a reminder, we'll certainly move forward with this. Representative Josephson, please.
Thank you. So I've actually learned a lot about navigability in the last 48 hours or so. And the reason I'm offering this amendment is I consulted with an attorney who's a water rights expert, and I just want to be clear that that the definition that's used in the bill could be restricted. And, of course, it's just a definition. It doesn't really have any action words, any verbs. It doesn't sort of make any policy, but the definition itself is sort of a policy. And our Constitution tells us, Article 8, Section 14, that there's a section called Access to Navigable Waters, and it says, free access to the navigable or public waters of the state as defined by the legislature shall not be denied any citizen of the United States or resident of the state. So very broad, but then it says, except that the legislature may by general law regulate and limit such access for other beneficial use or public purpose. And it was recommended to me that under Title V, there's a huge number of fish and game regulations, many created by the Board of Game. I then did some further research, and I found a decision from 15 years ago called Interior Alaska Airboat Association, which concerned regs in the Nenana region and the Noatak River. And whether or not, for example, on a navigable waterway, the Board of Game could say, you can't use an airboat there, you can't use an aircraft there. And the Supreme Court said, sure, it can do that. And so I didn't, I wanted the record to reflect that it's not necessarily pell-mell, go do whatever you want to do across Alaska's navigable waters. And that was principally why I wanted to offer this amendment.
Okay. Discussion? Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On page 2, line 5, which is authorized by the commissioner after reasonable public notice, to me that is regulation. So I think it's covered already in the bill. So
okay,
I don't
thank
know
you.
If it's necessary to add regulation. I don't think it does add to or detract either way.
Any further discussion?
Thank you.
My comment would be I will add that the legislature as a body, I believe, kind of defines the law of the state, which I think engages in the departments to actually create regulation via the legislative process. So I think the question that I would have is, since we have law covered in there, are we being somewhat redundant by adding the word regulation? That I'm certainly no legal expert at all, but since we've got it covered with law, that's how regulations actually are born, is via the law that we provide, I believe. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, didn't have this before to ask opinion from legal, but I'm pretty sure that law does include law and regulations of the state. It's not simply by statute. Law is a broader term, and that's my understanding in seeing this bill, is that law includes both statute and regulation.
Any further? Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just sort of struggling with that because I think that may be an accurate assessment, but it seems if you put it more explicitly in there, in a sense it's a bit more permissive, if you will, because it's more clear what I guess it would be inferred, but it seems that it could be more clear. And in some ways, I mean, that section is saying, you know, that you may not obstruct or interfere with this unless the obstruction or interference is authorized. So by actually saying regulation, it seems that you're making it more sort of permissive, if you will. But perhaps it isn't necessary. I don't know if we could take a brief at ease and make a phone call just to see if Ledge Legal could answer that point.
I don't know. I hate to do much of a delay. I personally don't have a lot of heartburn with it. That's probably not the appropriate legislative term, but I am who I am. I don't have a lot of heartburn with that actually being in there. I'm not sure how necessary it is, but I don't have a lot of heartburn with it. I think everyone at the table understands what I just said, I believe. Representative Herron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, I view it as a belt and suspenders amendment. I would have to concur with others around the table that it's sure you can do it, but I think it's just, like you said, it's redundant.
Yeah.
Well, what I will do, I will remove my objection, but is there any further objection? No further objection? Okay, well, seeing no further objection, we will adopt conceptual amendment number 1. Thank you, Representative Josephson, very much. Is there any further discussion on House Bill 216? If not, I would entertain Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry I didn't speak up. I just wanted to thank your staff for addressing those concerns. I know, you know, just the sensitive areas issue was what I was concerned about, so we were looking at, you know, some of the protections for anadromous streams, so that was really helpful. So I appreciate the update in that and just making sure that, you know, that there are other opportunities. And I hope that why I wanted to just sort of say something, in case there are anybody who cares, we had a lot of people testify on this bill and they're listening, you know, we just want them to know, you know, that as this definition becomes more broad, we still, you know, all care very much about our salmon and don't want to have any unintended consequences. So I appreciate that information and having the security of knowing those other statutory provisions will accomplish that. And then hope as a little public service announcement to any of the supporters who are the ones, you know, using these different motorized vehicles and whatnot, that we'll all keep that in mind and do a good job on that. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Tarr. And as a sponsor of the bill, I'll let you know, the committee members, I appreciate your questions and bringing those things forward to vet those things out. I think our responsibility is to make sure that we vet these things and we go and pursue those answers and get those for us so that we're all much more comfortable with what we do and that we have investigated these things as much as possible. Representative Seaton?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And in that vein, as this bill goes forward, because not wanting to hold anything up, but hearing the definition that was read in, that people have basically unlimited access to waters of the state, I believe was the definition. And when we're putting these other methods in here, all-terrain vehicles, snow machines, et cetera, hopefully you'll investigate and find out whether upon that at any in any season has water in it, is navigable, to make sure we're not expanding access of citizens to private property, a pond on private property. I think that would be very good to clarify that we're not, by expanding the definition and what can be used there, that we want to make sure that we're not invading private property by statute allowing people access. So I just, as the bill goes forward, but I just didn't think about that until I heard the definition raised here. Otherwise, I'd have talked to you already. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Okay, I would entertain a motion, Mr. Co-Chair.
Mr. Chair, I make a motion to move the committee substitute for House Bill 216-209-LS-0995/E from committee with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
As amended.
Hmm?
As amended.
As amended.
All right. Thank you very much. Motion's been made to move the bill. Are there any objections? All right. Then this HB 216 moves from committee. Thank you very much. We'll take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork. We'll call the meeting back to order, and we're going to move to House Bill number 274. I believe we have staff for Representative Munoz here, so if you would please come forward and identify yourself for the record and present the bill to us. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Crystal Kieneman, staff to Representative Munoz. She does send her regards for not being able to attend the hearing today. She is out dealing with a personal family matter right now. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, again, thank you for the opportunity for us to present House Bill 274. We introduced House Bill 274 after working with a local nonprofit here in town. They had approached our office after many, many years of working with the Department of Natural Resources on trying to get a land exchange completed. So through our research, we researched the statutes, talked with DNR, tried to figure out what was going on and what was preventing them from completing a land exchange. And through that process, what we determined is that it wasn't just this one local nonprofit, that there are many other corporations, Native Corps, even land exchanges through the Alaska Mental Health Trust, and federal land exchanges that seem to be running into the same issues. So as we delved further in, we realized that there were inefficiencies within Title 3850 and the way that the statutes were governing the land exchanges. Title 3850, the way the land exchanges are written, are different than the municipal land exchanges. One of the main differences with the state land exchanges versus the municipal ones is that the value of the land that's being appraised needs to be exactly equal to when you're talking about the surveying of land. Now, with the municipal land exchanges, they call for it to be approximately equal to. And what that allows is for other factors to be weighed in considering land exchanges, public interest, access to the land, things of that nature, which Title 3850 doesn't allow for. So that was one of the major hurdles in state land exchanges. The other issue that we ran into was that appraisals under 3850 needed were only good for 1 year. Now, with public comment period, talking and going through the public process, the application, survey work, most of the land exchanges were running into that 1 year time frame, and it was very difficult to complete the land exchanges within that 1 year. So what 274 does is it removes that 1 year limitation, allowing those land exchanges that are close to being completed, that the state is determined to be in the best interest of the state, as well as through public comment, ensuring that all the issues surrounding those land exchanges are well vetted and making sure that all considerations are taken into account, that it then allows for the final paperwork to be completed. So, Mr. Chairman, I'll give deference to the committee. I'm more than happy to go through a sectional analysis, discuss the repealers of the bill, whatever the committee prefers.
I believe the committee would probably appreciate that if you could do that for us.
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman. So, section one of
I'm sorry, Representative Seaton, did you have a question?
No, that's okay.
Okay.
Sorry, thanks.
Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Section one of the bill removes a reference that is being repealed. It deals with the coordination with other state agencies, and I'll get into a little bit more detail of that in the repealer section. Section two of the bill deals with the extension of certain land leases if it's in the best interest of the state. Section 3 applies to existing notice standards to state land exchanges. You'll see a new sub 7, which adds in the provisions contained in 274 into the current notice provisions. Section 4 of the bill is clarifying language regarding the definition of shoreland and tideland. That's a technical cleanup from legislative legal. Section 5 of the bill adds two new provisions. The provisions are the land exchange must be in the best interest of the state, and that the requirements of the public notice provision under AS 3805945 apply. Section 6 of the bill provides for land exchanges to be approximately equal in value. It also requires legislative approval of exchanges greater than $5 million. And this mirrors the municipal land exchange statutes. Section 7 of the bill removes the equal value provision that was changed to approximately equal to in Section 6 of the bill. Section 8 removes existing limitations and outlines that the conveyances must be authorized by the state constitution and federal laws. Section 9 of the bill provides for the continuation of revenue accrual until state land is conveyed unless jurisdiction from other state agencies is waived. Section 10 of the bill changes the hearing requirements on land valued at more than $5 million. It changes it from three public hearings to one public meeting prior to it being submitted to the legislature for review.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Herron.
Yeah, this is the one I have, this section is the one I have a concern on. sort of prefacing that, that is that so instead of equal or above value, we're going to consider trades that are could be less than value, less than the first value. But when we get over here to the 5 million, current is at least three hearings, and but why would we want to reduce it to one hearing when it's over 5 million?
Representative Herron, through the chair, in talking with the department and other nonprofits and those that wish to make land exchanges, the way that DNR conducts public hearings is a much higher bar than their public meetings. And we went back and forth on this as well, because we don't want to limit public participation. We want to ensure that all the issues are vetted. But we also understand the need for the timeline of getting land exchanges taken care of. Additionally, with the additional oversight of the legislature, we felt comfortable knowing that the legislature would do its due diligence on these land exchanges. Multiple public meetings, legislative hearings, could be held regarding these land exchanges, and so therefore we feel that the public would be well served, and there would be no diminishment of
follow-up.
Okay, so in reading the red highlighted words in the two blocks, status quo is at least three hearings, and then in the proposed, at least one public meeting. What's the difference between a hearing and a public meeting?
The difference between a public hearing and a public meeting, the commissioner must attend the public hearings. They also, my understanding is that they need to be, they need to have recorders there, transcribed. It's a much higher bar than having, say, like a town hall hearing, where you could have more of a free-form discussion through those meetings.
So, Mr. Chairman, I guess a comment on these couple of questions that I have posed is land exchanges shouldn't be easy. And it's just a concern. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mm-hmm.
Representative Josephson, and then Representative Seaton, did you also have a question? We'll let Representative Josephson.
Thank
please.
You, Mr. Chair. Ms. Kuhneman, following up on Representative Herron's comment, and I make this sound like I've read every single thing that's ever been emailed to me, including the attachments, and every email, which I nearly have. But if there isn't a hearing, then we wouldn't be privy to what was said at the hearing. It would be a public meeting, and we'd read a press account of it, probably, right?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, I do have the department here, and they can go into more depth on the hearings, but my understanding is that we would still be privy to a great deal of information that was presented at that hearing.
Representative Seaton?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, and I'm seeing this for the first time, too, here, but I'm a little concerned. I mean, we have a area right now on the Kosilof River, and there's a proposal that went out, and there's three public hearings. One's in Wasilla, one's in Anchorage, and one's in Kosilof. But if they just had the one in Kosilof as a public meeting, I can tell you absolutely the opinion coming out of there is going to be totally different than if you have three meetings in different places, because it relates to dip netting. And I can just tell you that the people from the population centers have a definitely different attitude that than the property owners that live around the that area and, you know, have the impact of that. So I'm concerned that it goes to a public meeting instead of three public hearings, and I'd also like to get the definition of public meeting versus public hearing, because normally we get the notice of public hearings, and I don't necessarily get public meetings. So just wanted to, as questions go forward.
Okay.
And Representative Seaton, through the chair, the language states that it that they shall hold at least one public meeting. It doesn't limit them to just one. It does allow for, if there is public outcry, if there is interested parties, that they can request more than one meeting. So it doesn't limit DNR's ability to hold multiple meetings. Additionally, the public meetings still do go through the public notice requirement, and so they are sent out to all interested parties. So there is still that awareness and ensuring that, that every affected party does have the ability to comment on this. And this is in addition to the public notice provisions that are contained in statute. So they would have already had a chance to submit their comments through the public notice. The department would have had a chance and an opportunity to review those public comments and determine where the issues are and which communities would be greatly affected by that.
If you want to continue and finish, that would be great.
Yes, sir. Section 11 of the bill is conforming language regarding the legislative review for changes made in Section 6 and 13. Section 12 is additional clarifying language for the definition of shoreland and tideland for another section of statute. And Section 13 goes into the repealers. And if Mr. Chair, I'll continue with the repealers, if
please
you would like. The first repealer is 3850.020, which deals with the value of properties exchanged. This language is being repealed because of Section 6 of the bill, which changes the language from exactly equal to approximately equal. The next repealer, 3850.040, is the land subject to exchange. This language in statute was put in, although the state doesn't have the legal authority to violate a covenant or a restriction on a title that prevents the disposal or land exchange, and so LegLegal had determined that this statute doesn't seem to hold any functional value, so that's the reason for that repealer. 3850.080B is the prohibition against alienation of section rights. The state has already selected their lands under the Alaska Statehood Act and has no further ability to select lands. That's the reason for that repealer.
Chairman. Representative Chenault.
Mr. Chairman, on that point, I don't believe Alaska has selected all of their lands yet. I think that there still are lands that are available. I may be mistaken, but I think that there are.
I think so, too.
And, Mr. Chairman, that's the information that I was provided with. I would be more than happy to follow
maybe
back up
on. Maybe something we can get from the department.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The next repealer is 3850.090, coordination with other state agencies. This requirement has been replaced with the requirements under 3805.035E, which includes a requirement to provide a summary of agency and public comments that have been obtained with as a result of the contacts with other agencies and other efforts taken by the department through public comment. 3850.100 is the finding requirements as to alternatives. This has been replaced under the process in 3805.035E, which requires a written determination that the exchanges will serve the best interest of the state. 3850110 is the notice of proposed exchanges. Again, this was replaced with the requirements of 3805945, which is the standard for most of the other disposals, including oil and gas leases, land sales, material sales, and other leases. 3850120B is the public hearing statutes, which was replaced by Section 10 of the bill. And lastly, 3850130 is the report on proposed exchanges, and this is a duplicative reporting requirement of existing requirements for publications of the best interest finding, and it adds costs and complexities to the exchange process. The best interest decision will still lay out the considerations used in determining the value of the property, the value of the exchange, and what the benefits are of the exchange.
Thank you. Representative Justifson. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, Ms. Kroneman, a couple questions for you. The repealer of 080B, the state may not alienate land selected under Statehood Act. I'm not sure I've ever seen a map that shows what we received as of January 3rd, 1959. Statehood Act was 58, I guess. Is there some reason why lawmakers eons ago said that sacred land, we're not exchanging it? Whereas land, I guess, that we've accepted since then, we've exchanged, albeit very slowly.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Josephson, I would defer to the department.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Crystal, if you have someone from the department here, would you mind if they joined you?
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman.
Maybe we could address the land and potentially address the public hearing, public meeting question as well. And could you please identify yourself for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I'm Wynn Menefee. I'm the Deputy Director of the Trust Land Office, and I also used to be the Chief Operations for Mining, Land, and Water. To address the first, we'll talk about the selection rights. At statehood, we had 100 million acres or 105 million acres to select, and certain came through grants, certain were needed to be selected. We had a time period in which to select lands. The selections have already occurred. What we're in the process now is figuring out, of the remaining selections that we have, which ones are we relinquishing and which ones are we closing, but we don't have the ability to select more. So that's why at the time of the bill, this statute was created, we likely had the ability to select lands. Thus, that's the reason why currently it's not needed. Now, we do have the ability to change what's our priority in selection and change or close out a selection, but we don't have the ability to select more. To answer the second question that was brought up that seems to be of concern is this difference between meetings and hearings. And the issue with meetings and hearings is that a hearing, according to the way DNR interprets that, is that we have to have essentially a court transcriber type person there that is typing out every word that's said. We have to then pay for somebody to process that and get it all published. And that's a very lengthy procedure for us to do because we're not normally doing that. We dispose of oil and gas leases, mineral rights. We do land sales, all under 3805-035E decisions. And we use public meetings where we reach out, we gather input from the public, we document the type of input that we get at the public meetings, but we just don't transcribe and go to that type of system where somebody gets on the record and does that. What we have found much more beneficial is to have meetings where we can have dialogue with people. We get their feedback, but if somebody wants to give us their ideas, rather than constraining them to a 2-minute or a 3-minute, that's it, we like to have meetings where we can discuss things with people, and we sit down and we hear their concerns, we talk about solutions, and that's not a hearing. That's a meeting. So that's why we prefer to have meetings instead. And just for clarification, under 945, 3805, 945, our public notice requirements for our decision process, which is 3805-035E, that's the decision process. Public notice is 945. The combination of those two require us to reach out to potentially affected parties. To the most, the best way we see fit to reach the potentially affected parties. It could be that we just determine that we need six public meetings to do that. It might be that we only need one. But if it's under the $5 million threshold, it leaves the department the decision-making authority to figure out how much notice do we need to go or how many meetings do we have to do. Do we even need a public meeting? Maybe it's such a small thing in just in a subdivision or something, it's just one little teeny piece that we could do that we don't really need a public meeting. We go out to public notice. We always have public notice. We're always going to post it on the internet, and we're going to post it probably in the local newspaper. So we're going to do outreach. But the need to go through multiple meetings is not always essential. Now, if it's over $5 million, just as Crystal said, that we would be needing to bring that to the legislature. The legislature could have as many hearings as they would like on that in order to approve that. We can't do over $5 million or an unequal land exchange without going to get the legislator's approval. So therefore, that's where even more hearings occur. The requirement for the three hearings is only for, in the current law, is only for if it's over $5 million. So it seems even repetitive. We'll do public meetings and such as necessary up to that point. But when we finally say, yes, it's a good exchange, we're ready for the legislative approval, you can hold as many hearings as you would like on that.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess, you know, I presume that written public comment to public hearings, we know they're there and they're full and in the record. Is that the case? How is that written public comment acquired from the public meeting, and is it verbatim as the person wrote that, or is it summarized as someone commented in the positive or in the negative instead of their actual comments?
Representative Seaton, through the chair. The answer to that is when we do a 035E decision, we do a summary of comments received, because sometimes you could have one comment, you could have 1,000 comments. We oftentimes do a summary, but the public record is there that documents it. We tell people that in order to be heard, we want you to put it in writing. We want, therefore, we don't mistakenly put words in somebody's mouth. We want them to write it down. So at any public meeting, we have forms that we have in the back that say, please, we'll even help you if you need help in writing this down, but we want it in writing. So we actually either have them write it on the form, send it afterwards, or we will actually help them write it and say, is this what you said? And then they can sign it. But the idea is we want them to put the words in, down on paper. So that's in the public record. That's available for anybody to see when we're doing notices or doing decisions. But in the actual decision document, we oftentimes summarize.
Follow up. Thanks. And if we're talking about over $5 million and going from at least three, to one or more, my concern is sitting here in the legislature, we get these things come to fore us, and if there's only been one public hearing, one public meeting on the issue, my fear is that we get 50 people calling in and asking us to make a decision on something that wasn't as amply vetted in the local area as it should have been for us to really get, because these hearings are difficult here. They're not in the local area. Can you address that concern that I have of, I mean, we've had timber sales, we've had lands, you know, we've had these things, and if we're over $5 million, what is the do you see instances where you will only have one public meeting, or are you probably going to have three if it's over $5 million anyway?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, it's likely that if you're over $5 million, it's probably of a value that's affecting, it's either a broader land base that you're talking about, or it's a very, very, very valuable, like it, maybe it's right downtown somewhere in some community. But likely, there, if you're up in that type of value, you're probably going to be ending up having more than one hearing. If it's, let's say, accumulation of several different land parcels that are in different communities, we're going to have public meetings likely in each of those communities. It would be unlikely, I won't guarantee it, but I would say it's going to be unlikely that something is going to get to the legislature under that requirement, either of unequal value or of over $5 million. Either of those cases, I think it's going to be pretty unlikely that we won't have at least one or more public meeting, and well, we would have the one public meeting, but probably more, because we don't want to bring something to the legislature that's not vetted. We want to know what the problems are, what the concerns are, and it's not going to say that people won't ask for additional hearings with the legislature, but we would like to have that vetted out. So if it's going to take more hearings, we're going to hold more hearings, or meetings, sorry.
Any other questions? Representative Josephson.
Yes. Another area of inquiry here through the chair, Mr. Menifee, the Section 8 severing of the surface from the mineral estate seems like a pretty major shift. What's the goal here, and how would we know, for example, that we hadn't exchanged something that had, you know, valuable minerals or oil and gas under it?
Representative Josephson, through the chair. The issue that was brought up here is that before in the law, that it talked about trying to not do a mineral estate separately. The only group that we can dispose state land mineral rights to is the federal government, and so by law. So the fact that it says you can only do it according to the state constitution and law, we're not going to be able to segregate that and give it to Joe over here, because it's just not permissible by law. So, but it does allow the separation. For instance, if we're dealing with the federal government, there may be reasons that you only want to do a mineral estate in certain cases. Now, when we do this exchange, we typically, even under an exchange, we keep, because of the statutes here, we keep the rights to the oil and gas and such like that. Now, you could go through the decision process and argue why that is all necessary, but yes, we're going to evaluate that, because we do not want to give away a valuable resource. But the idea is the mineral resource, well, put it this way, normally exchanges are going to occur with fee simple, which is both the mineral estate and the land estate all together. But that's usually what's happening, is you're getting that in, and you're giving just surface estate back out in an exchange. That's the typical way it's going to work, is you're asking for somebody, whether it's a native corporation or whether it's a private entity that had a homestead, we want both the surface and the subsurface when we get it into the state. But when you give something back in exchange for it, you're only giving the surface estate. That is the common way you would deal with that.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Seaton.
Thank you. On Section 9 on page 4, can you just explain the end revenue section there?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, the issue here is that, just so there's no confusion, that what this clarifies is, let's use an example that you're selling gravel off of a site, and you're going through a land exchange process. You've come into a preliminary exchange agreement, but there's still gravel being extracted there. That other entity that you're exchanging with does not get any of the revenues off of that gravel extraction that continues until the actual exchange is complete, because you don't want them to say, well, this exchange took 10 years and I demand all the revenue that came off during that time. Well, we hadn't given that land to them until we're done. And therefore, the idea being is you want to be expeditious about going through an exchange, but you don't want them to be accruing any sort of right on the other side. You want to be keeping that to the state so that you keep the benefit of any revenues that come off that land until you're done with the exchange.
Any other questions? Representative Seaton.
Thank you. Are there any of the repealers that the department is in any way uncomfortable with or that expand further than we than is needed right now, or anything that has tails there that should be kept?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, we are comfortable with the way the bill is written. The repealers, you've already walked through them slightly here, but essentially what we see is either parts of those that were already in those pieces of language got moved up into another part. You know, there's some things that like got moved up into 010 that were in another part. So there's some of that that happens. Some of them are legislative legal telling us that that's what it should be. Some of them are just for efficiencies. I mean, so we're very comfortable with where it stands.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I noticed that you've included the use of the term best interests. Couldn't that result in more litigation that would just end up holding up the exchange, given that there's a whole body of law and what that means? I'm thinking of the Reddy decision, which was 3 or 4 years ago. Is that possible? Because that's a term of art, I think. Best interest.
Representative Josephson, through the chair. Every disposal, except for this, and there might be something else, but almost every disposal that DNR does is through the 3805-035 decision process, which says you have to decide it's in the best interest of the state. And when you say, couldn't that be challenged? The answer is absolutely. In fact, every decision that we do, somebody could appeal and take us to court eventually on it and challenge us if we were incorrect, if we did not do our due diligence, we didn't evaluate correctly, we didn't do everything that's required under 3805-035, we could get into a situation if we did our job poorly. Sure, we could be challenged. Well, we can be challenged whether we do a good job or a bad job. But nonetheless, we get taken to court all the time. So the point is, yes, it is a term of art. However, that is what the legislature set up for us to do all the disposals. And so, I mean, you look at the large oil and gas leases and such we do, or the land disposal, that whole land sale program, those are all done through that same decision process. Same appealable process is there, same best interest determination.
Any other questions? You had mentioned the subsurface rights or the mineral rights, and maybe you can help me out. I might be way off here, but wasn't that an agreement at the Statehood Act that if the state surrendered any mineral rights that they would go back to the federal government?
Through the chair, yes. Absolutely.
Oh, okay.
I think it's 6I.
I would assume it would be the feeling of everyone listening to this that would never happen.
That's
correct. We would never, ever give those up.
And that's correct. And the reason, except if it was going back to the federal government. So there is an allowance there, and there are exchanges to the federal government possible in the future. You know, that, in fact, the Trust Land Office is working on an exchange with the federal government. However, mineral rights weren't really the issue there. But nonetheless, in the future, I'm saying it could be a possibility that you could exchange mineral rights back to the federal government, but that's the only place that works.
And then you had talked about our land selection, so I would assume that what we really face with some of our land is that has not been adjudicated yet. And so we have selections out there. And we would have to work directly with, I assume, the Bureau of Land Management to do that adjudication for the state to acquire the rest of their acreage.
Yes, Chairman, the selections have already occurred. We're over-selected. Mm-hmm. And so in that over-selection, we have to work with BLM to fine-tune what we're going to get in the end. And it's, I'll call it somewhat like a chess game. The native corporations get first dibs on selections, and then from what remains, we'll adjust our priorities, and then we will get the remaining selection. So it's still under adjudication, it's still a process ongoing.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions for either of our testifiers.
Are we pressed for time? Can I pursue?
Please, go ahead.
Thank you. Following up on this, the federal exchange, I mean, when I first looked at this, I think of the Echo Bend or whatever it is up at Point Bridget, so I'm sort of envisioning private land. You said there's an exchange going on now. I have a two-part question. How many of these involve the federal government, just roughly? And tell us, if you can, just to give us a sort of a mental image, what's about this federal exchange that's going on now? Is that possible to do that?
Representative Sim, through the chair. When you say how many are going on right now,
that are federal,
I can only think, and I could be wrong, but I can only think of two that have been in any way going on right now, and that's that out at Eisenbeck, there's an exchange, but that exchange has been going on quite some time with many perils with the exchange and all that.
Yeah.
So, but nonetheless, there's not under 3850. There's not an exchange going on presently. Okay. Mm-hmm. There's many different ways to do exchanges. Just stated is with the federal government, you can do an administrative exchange and you can do a congressionally mandated exchange. Mm-hmm. And so that just, they say, make it happen. So if we're talking about the administrative exchange, that's more like what we're doing with the Trust Land Office, where we're working with the Forest Service in Southeast to do an exchange for approximately 18,000 acres of trust land for about 20,000 some acres of Forest Service lands. And there's many parcels down in Southeast. It's a fairly large process and a lengthy process. Right now, we have entered into an agreement to initiate with the federal government. There's a NEPA process that has to occur, an EIS. We have to go through all of that before we ever do the 3850 land exchange on the state side. And so we're just in the, I'll call it, in the first stages of real robust process that on the federal side. And then you have to marry it up. Currently, the way 3850 stands is, especially with this appraisal problem of only being good for 1 year, it wreaks havoc in that. And as an example, there was an exchange process, Falls Creek, that took multiple years. It took some actions legislatively and congressionally to make that happen, but that was with the National Park Service, and I think it took at least 12 years or maybe more to get that exchange through, because you're trying to match the federal process with the state process, and that's problematic nonetheless. But so those are the only ones that are currently going on in my knowledge.
Thank you. Representative Herron.
Well, since it came up on the Eisenbeck trade, first I'll make a comment, then I'll ask you the question. Is the Eisenbeck trade is there's a lot of bitter resentment to the way the federal government has treated that trade, and it was because of a very successful EIS process, 4 years in the making, done with a lot of Alaskans and by many, many parties interested in a successful conclusion to that trade. And the EIS was, this is my opinion, but was corrupted at the highest levels of the Department of the Interior at the last minute. So could you tell us when that trade agreement's going to expire because of congressional action?
Representative Herron, through the chair, I actually can't off the top of my head.
Okay.
That's something that DNR can get back to you on, but I don't know the answer.
Yes, if you could provide that to the chair, and we'll thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the criticisms I've heard before of the whole land exchange process is just because it can take such great length of time, you know, it's you may exceed costs through the process relative to the value of the property. And I'm just wondering if, you know, some of the cleanup here will help, if that's an accurate criticism, and if that will help overall in the process to where it would make it more advantageous for other individuals to consider land exchanges, you know, to expedite the process at all.
Representative Tarr, through the chair, I think that's accurate in the sense that we have had numerous, I say numerous, failed exchanges. Exchanges never got off the ground because of process. The 3850, the way the timing worked and everything, it was extremely difficult to get an exchange through. And many years in the making, many repeated steps, lots of cost, both for the state and for whoever was proposing to exchange with the state. It's not good for the individuals trying to do an exchange. It's not good for the state because we waste a lot of money that way. And staff time that repeat processes over and over again. The intention of this bill is to make it more consistent with how we do normal disposals. And when I say streamline it a bit, sometimes that's a bad word, some people say, but really what we're trying to do is get efficiency so we can actually get this done. Mm-hmm. We have numerous people that have come to us and entities, native corporations, that have come to us and said, we really want to do an exchange. Here's why it's in the state's best interest. And we've oftentimes said, we're probably not going to be able to get it done because of the law as it stands. That's not a good answer because it might actually be in the state's interest. But we want to be able to, when it is in the state's interest, actually complete an exchange.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, if I may add, the example I used at the beginning, dealing with the Point Bridget Trailhead and the Echo Ranch Bible Camp, they started that process early 2000s. They have dumped tens of thousands of dollars into this over and over, year after year, trying to get this exchange. And it's it's a frustrating ordeal for them. I mean, they're a nonprofit. They should be using those funds for other purposes instead of exchanges. So the hope is that there will be additional public entities that won't have to expend those same funds and that it would be more cost advantageous for land exchanges.
Mm-hmm. Any further questions for either of these folks? Thank you very much for the presentation. I certainly appreciate it. And we are going to open public testimony now and go to the Fairbanks Legislative Information Office. I'd like to remind those that are going to testify, please limit your testimony to 3 minutes. And if we could go to Mr. Doug Isaacson. Doug, if you're there, could you please identify yourself for the record, your affiliation, and provide your testimony?
Sounds familiar.
Maybe you forgot how to testify.
It sounds like he's talking, but there's no.
No, they just went away?
Volume.
You got scared.
No, bounced off.
Maybe. Oh, okay. So the Fairbanks LIO, Matt, is just went away? All right. Do we have anyone here in the room that wishes to testify? We'll take a brief at ease. Come back to order, and we'll go to the Fairbanks Legislative Information Office and Mr. Doug Isaacson. Doug, if you're there, could you give us your name and affiliation for the record and give us a 3-minute testimony, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize for that technical error. That was operator malfunction on my part. My name is Doug Isaacson. I am the general manager of the Minto Development Corporation. Minto is the ANCSA federally recognized village. And I am a subsidiary of the Setia Corporation, which is the village corporation. It's an honor to be seeing you guys again and speaking with you on behalf of supporting HB 274. I appreciate the conversation that has already taken place and the explanations that we heard from Director Menefee. In speaking about these issues, as a Native corporation, and we're looking at economic development for our village, work for our shareholders, and the ability to create value for the greater community at large, whether it's in Minto or Fairbanks or Anchorage, wherever it might be, we are discouraged from pursuing any land swap, say, for remoter parcels on the Elliott Highway to something that might be on the Richardson, due to the process. This is something, if I could just relate back to my experience as the mayor of North Pole, where we had we were looking at expanding our wastewater treatment center, and the exchange process became too cumbersome for us to pursue in that process as well. So when this bill became apparent, and having worked with the chair on something similar over the summer, it was immediately received well by my board and the parent board, and you have in front of you a letter, two letters actually, one from the Minto Development Corporation from Roxanne Frank, the president of my board, and then from Edna Riley, who also is the president of the board for the Seth Yaw Corporation. And we're looking at pursuing some ventures that, if this is passed, would open up some economic opportunity. So I would echo the idea that Director Menefee has stated that this is reasonable to reduce the number of public meetings. It doesn't say that you won't have public meetings, but in the municipal process for this land issues, you usually reach out to those who are immediately affected by exchanges. If you're doing something in an area that isn't going to have a lot of effect, and having three mandated public hearings, that just doesn't make sense. And so at the discretion of the director of lands, this is a much more reasonable way of pursuing it. It would allow us to then appraise the property, go through the best interest findings, and get a determination in a much more timely way. So thank you for your time. I appreciate this opportunity.
Thank you. Have any questions for Doug? Thank you for your testimony, Doug. We appreciate it. And next we'll go to the Fairbanks Legislative Information Office and Bart Garber. Could you please give us...
How do you do, sir and chair and committee? My name is Bart Garber. I'm president and CEO of Togatili Corporation, the village corporation in Nenana. And I echo Minto's testimony here. In Nenana, we have an even a little bit more extreme case, potentially. By the time Nenana got around to, and Togatili got around to, selecting lands, the vast majority of the lands in our area had already been selected by the state and by the city. Both are, you know, old institutions in that area. And so our lands are primarily distant, and some of them, and lots of them, are split up along the road system there, or further out on some of the river systems. There have already been times where we needed, or there was an opportunity to exchange, and it was a little bit more it was easier, I should say, with the city, when the city and the village had to make a land exchange. The parties were more similar, the parcels were smaller, and the interests were more in line. We now have increasing amounts of development in the area. Our parcels are still all spread out, and we're getting into more and more areas where the state has lands. We're not talking about large parcels, but potentially just small parcels that are loggerheads for access issues and other things. I know that this last year I had to make arrangements for the lease of a very small state parcel that was between our property and some mental health property that we had to get to. That worked out okay, but it might have been easier, and in the long term it may be easier simply to get an exchange. And currently, given the current process, you've got a very, very good chance of not going through it, simply because of the time deadlines and simply because of the length of the transaction. And so we promote this legislation, and we would like to see the number of hearings potentially diminished, or at least sped up, so that in most situations where both parties are in agreement, at least the principal parties are in agreement, that this would be in the best interest of both of them, that the process doesn't get in the way. And that's my testimony. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Garber? Thank you very much for your testimony. Do we have anyone else online? There's no one else online. Is there anyone here that would like to testify? Seeing none, we'll close public testimony, and we will go to committee comments. Any comments from the committee? Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am concerned that in a time of budget constraints, the I worry about the future administrative contraction of saving expenses by having a single hearing and then shoving that off to us as having multiple hearings but not having heard from the public, and that is in those sales over the $5 million limit. So at the appropriate time, Mr. Chairman, I would like us to go from one to three, staying with public meetings instead of public hearings, which would be simpler and easier, but at least we would make sure that we weren't shifting budgetary problems from an administration to the legislature. And I've just been through too many of these timber sales or exchanges that were very contentious by the time they got here, and some of that was because that hadn't been worked out in public meetings. So I think the idea of public meetings is very good instead of public hearings, but I think that we should not go down to one for those things over $5 million.
Any other comments? I'd let you know that we're planning on holding this bill, but we will bring it up in the very near future, near potentially sometime next week. So with those suggestions and recommended amendments, I'd let you know that if you can get them to our offices, that would be preferable for sure.
And Mr. Chairman?
Representative Seaton.
Do you want that as a ledge legal for it to change from 3-1, a number change?
Our preference would be, yes, okay. to have that way. I think it makes it easier for all
That's
of
fine.
Us as well.
Okay.
So are there any other comments? All right. Well, we will move on then. We'll hold this bill, and we will bring it up in the very, very near future. And at this time, I think Representative Nagyak wanted to speak to us just a little bit about House Bill 247.
We'll present thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll present this to us for House Bill 247 tomorrow at 1 p.m. The CS will be available to all members of the and the public at that time. Committee members are hereby notified that all amendments have to be drafted by legislative legal and related to the CS. All amendments must be submitted to both co-chairs' offices no later than 5 p.m. Monday, March 21st. On Saturday, we'll also hear from Analytica, and on Monday, we'll hear from the administration regarding a committee substitute for House Bill 247. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other committee comments? Representative Tarr?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I just want to double check that I have all the dates right. So 5 p.m. on Monday is amendments are due,
mm-hmm.
And we'll have the department before us at 1 o'clock that day?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Should be.
I will try. We're not going to see the committee substitute today, then, sounds like, not until tomorrow, Mr. Chairman. Okay. So I only have a slight concern that hearing from the department at 1 o'clock and then having only until 5 o'clock to get any amendments in, hopefully that will work out okay. Do, you know, make a commitment to do that? I'm just sort of anticipating, okay, if they say something that's new information. But hopefully that won't be an issue. If we get done at 3, then we'd still have a couple of hours to...
Did you say have the meeting till at 5 also, or no?
No, Mr. Chairman, you were saying have amendments due by 5 p.m.?
Yes. Uh-huh.
And so I was just thinking if we hear from the department at the 1 o'clock meeting,
yeah.
And then we'll be in committee until 3 p.m.,
yes.
Hopefully that two-hour window will be enough if there's anything between hearing from the department and having amendments due to be able to get those in
yeah.
and taken care of. So I just wanted to sort of make that known that I just hope that's enough time, is all.
Representative Olson.
Point of clarification, we'll probably be hearing from the department tomorrow as well, won't we?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I mm-hmm. only heard Monday, so apologize if I missed that. I heard Analytica Saturday and department Monday, so.
And you have any other follow-up, Representative Nagyap?
No.
Thank you very much.
I mean.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any further comments from the committee or any other? There's no other business to come before the committee. So we are actually going to recess until 1 p.m. tomorrow on Saturday. So we are in recess.